I'm going to go to the hospital. Thank you. Yes, that's good. And we need to be able to tell you, I'm going to talk to you, and you're not going to be able to tell you. The man of Isaac was very talented. this is important. This is as late as yesterday when I last stopped in my office. The Federal Energy Administration, the President's report on Alaskan oil pricing is due this Friday, the 15th of April. What we understand that will be is not the decision, but kind of an options paper outlining all the choices from which the President may ultimately choose. Word has it that the decision will come, at least initially, by President Carter, in his national energy policy message that he has set down for April 20th, at his own deadline. Whether or not it comes then is another question. We understand that some members of Congress have asked that he defer this statement 7 to 10 days. They've been on recess and apparently want to do some preparation when they come back. Our best information right now is it will be incorporated at least in the first instance in the President's National Energy Policy Message, and that it may be sometime between the 20th and the 30th of this month. Whenever that happens, the next thing that will happen in Washington will follow this pattern. A number of committees in the Congress have already begun to schedule hearings to have discussion and input on the policy message itself. There's draft legislation, and we haven't seen it, in the White House on some of these things, and some of it apparently does relate to Alaskan oil prices. When the legislation is introduced, there will be a second round of hearings and referrals to a variety of committees in the Congress. What we're anxious to know is when are they going to decide, so we know where we are. Our best guess at the present time, and that is all it is, sometime about midsummer, if lucky, you'll know. Now, between now and then, we're looking in our own offices, and I presume in our own industry, at a lot of continuing advocacy on the necessity of maximum incentives for Arctic resource development. It's a close question. There is a tendency to try to do something for everybody, and when that happens, people in this room pay the price. In a sense, I'm asking, I go back to a great old line. You got a time here when you almost have to hang together, you hang separately. And Alaska has done a good job in advocacy, but we don't want to get out of step with each other. Frankly, I still think it's the most important thing going right now. So where you are as a state, in summary, are these first three areas. Your near-term revenue needs are met. You're out of the woods on that. You have some time to make the policy choices on tax, legislation, and direction. This is not a put-off till next year, 10 years away. We'll all come back to this. I have no doubt about that. But it strikes us as the absolute wrong time to not work together on the question of what. It takes the effort that it deserves to do a good job. Now, if I can try to respond to some of the other questions that you have raised in your hearing in the last day, maybe I'm anticipating, but looking through notes and whatnot last night, it seemed to me there were three areas, perhaps, or four, that there'd been a lot of questions on, and maybe just on a volunteer basis, try to address them and any other questions you have. The first of these areas concerns the legality of some of the tax measures before the legislature. Yesterday, there was sort of an assumed legality, and in one instance, an attitude that it may not be legal, but let's give it a whirl. I'm not sure if you've all had a chance to examine all the testimony in this book, but there are a few pages on the legality that goes a long way to summarize it as an overview. If you permit me, let me just give you that as a piece of the testimony. Starts at page 16. In the first four paragraphs, some of you know that I've always been reluctant to argue legalities of proposed legislation. It sometimes produces more misunderstanding than help. It is, however, a subject of concern from time to time on the part of the legislature itself, the administration, and our industry. Well, as you know, we routinely review the significant legislative proposals for legality. With a number of bills before this legislature and the diversity of their concepts, we've only had time to make a preliminary review. For what it's worth, and not to be argumentative again, let me give you some first observations. They suggest that further legal analysis may be appropriate for both the state and ourselves. Well, in addition to the numerical facts of the matter, there are some circumstances in the overall setting which I believe bear on the legality of further tax proposals here. For about 7 years, or perhaps a little longer, the state has made persistent efforts to increase its tax revenues from oil and gas activities in Alaska, and particularly its expected revenues from Poudre Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The focus has been rather narrow, and the principal burden has been directed to a few larger companies who have come to the state to engage in oil and gas exploration, development, and transportation. Most all of such taxes impact upon interstate commerce by reason of the fact that over 99% of the markets for this Alaskan industry are located outside the state. The results of the tax laws presently on the books, and it's generally recognized that these laws as now constituted will produce revenues far in excess of the state's revenue needs over the next decade and beyond. There have been no real specific revenue need justification attempted for the new tax proposals before this legislature. The cumulative effect of all this raises questions whether further substantial taxes become a confiscation of an equity interest or a modification of a royalty contract after a lease has been sold. The cumulative effect raises the question of a demonstrable bias against interstate commerce that would lead a court to conclude that this package of taxes discriminates against and unduly burdens interstate commerce. And again, let me say that I'm outlining these questions to point up these areas that you should examine and not to be argumentative. You may also be interested in some specific comments on the new income tax proposals before your committee. My comments in this regard relate essentially to two legal concepts, fairness and uniformity. Fairness to the taxpayer, of course, is something that should characterize all taxes that the government imposes. It takes on added dimension, however, in the context of the federal system, where in addition to the exactions of the national government, the company can be obliged to contribute to the fiscal needs of as many as 50 state governments. If such businesses are not to bear a disproportionate share of the total tax burden, it is essential that the taxes imposed by each jurisdiction reflect a high sense of equity, of fairness, in determining the portion of the company's activities to be included in that state's tax base. This concern for fairness is embodied in the federal constitution, the Commerce Clause and the Due Process Clause, and is at the core of the approach which the Supreme Court has charted in construing those provisions as they relate to state taxing statutes. A similar sentiment emanates from the Equal Protection Clause. And thus, for example, the United States Supreme Court has said that a multi-state enterprise should not be made to bear more than its fair share of the cost of state government. The taxes imposed on income from interstate commerce should be fairly apportioned between the states in order to avoid the risk of multiple taxation, and that the tax should be a constitutionally fair demand by the state for that aspect of the interstate commerce to which the state bears a special relation. It's interesting and somewhat refreshing to me that a matter so fundamental to our federal system should be governed in the final analysis by a simple, penetrating, common-sense inquiry of its fairness. All as one might expect, the precise dimensions of this fairness standard have not been fully spelled out by the court. There are a number of decisions that shed some light along the way. For example, we know that it's not fair in terms of the Commerce Clause for a state taxing statute directly or indirectly to prefer local activity at the expense of interstate activity. The cases also tell us that it's unfair for a state to apply an imprecise apportionment formula which inflates the portion of the multinational enterprise included in its tax base. We know that it's unfair for a state to adopt an apportionment formula so plainly inconsistent of that prevailing in other states. The logical and inevitable consequence will be that interstate income is subjected to multiple taxation. Well, in the light of these indications, it would seem appropriate to your committee to give consideration to the provisions of each new proposal to ascertain how fairly each one treats the multi-state companies which are actively engaged in Alaska. The specific reference to the proposed oil and gas corporate franchise tax, there are several general lines of inquiry which I would recommend, which in turn will likely lead to further more specific questions. the proposed substitution of an extraction factor for the widely used sales factor would apportion the entire enterprise of a Mullistate taxpayer according to a factor which measures only the taxpayer's oil and gas extraction activity. The essential problem with this extraction factor is this, that unlike the standard crude factor, which measure activity common to virtually all profit-making endeavors, and thus will generally result in a fair estimate of the portion of the taxpayer's entire enterprise related to the state. The extraction factor is very narrowly based and seems wholly inappropriate to the task of apportioning the fruit of a multifaceted interstate enterprise. As a result, this factor in the case of Ohio provides an example. It would apportion to Alaska income derived from a wide variety of our activities that are wholly unrelated either to Alaska or to oil and gas extraction, such as chemical sales, patent licenses, coal and uranium extraction, sales of plastic products and feedstock, fertilizer sales. And even though none of these activities will be reflected in either the numerator or the denominator of the factor, well, I submit this overreach is all bounds of fairness. Moreover, as a result of the patent inconsistency of the extraction factor with the sales factor applied in the overwhelming majority of other states, the extraction factor will inevitably lead to multiple taxation of income derived from the sale or exchange of Alaskan oil out of state. Between Alaska and the state of Seal, for example, as much as 133% of this income would be taxed. So again, this well could be the impact on Ohio, because we have so little oil production elsewhere, and what we expect in Alaska, we virtually would have a factor of one for the state of Alaska, notwithstanding all of our activities in 22 other states. I ask you to consider whether this represents fair treatment of interstate commerce. There's another point here that's come up in these hearings. I'd like to address it a slightly different way. It's usually put this way. Why should a company come to Alaska to do some of its business not pay 9.4% of an income tax on all of its business, just like a state company here in the state is doing all of its business here? It has to pay. Isn't that a discrimination? Well, put that way, it has the ring of a discrimination. Let me come at it slightly differently. There's no trick about it. When you have a company in Alaska that has all of its activities here, all of its activity that produces all of its income is also here. Whether it's manufacturing, transportation, distribution, marketing, whatever it is, every function is right here in the state. And obviously you say that's subject to 9.4. States that don't have it quite that way in the distribution of their operation, but they have some business in Alaska in some place, and say, well, look, if you can say fairly what portion of all of our business really is attributable to Alaska, you can't really argue if you apply 9.4% to that portion that's attributable to Alaska. That, in effect, is the way your statute works. And if some company says, well, our overall rate that we pay to Alaska on our total business is 2% or 3%, maybe that's all right. Because if it's 9.4 of the business that actually does here, a portion of its activity, that may generate only 2 or 3%, but you've had your shot for the portion here. Other states may not have any income tax. Alaska's share may even be higher because its rate is a little higher than most other states. But if you look at the question of where is the business done, they apply the 9.4 or the part that's done here, then you've approached the question of fairness in a very judicious way. You might also want to refer to tables A, B, and C in our Ohio submission 3. And particularly the line on those tables, and this is attachment B in our testimony, it's the caption, effective composite state income tax rate on total taxable earnings. What you will see is a substantial jump in that percentage. Table A being present law, table B and C being the other types of income tax proposed. And what we believe it shows is a pretty clear demonstration in the numbers of the difficulty of tax impact that raises the constitutional question. And since I testified here in March, one of our men, Charlie Fletcher, as some of you know, was looking at this and said, you know, I think there's another problem here. Should we call it to their attention? Well, let's do it. At least there's no surprise if we have to raise it later. And what he did was this, and it's summarized on this single sheet of paper, and I'd like to offer this for your record as well. Before you read these paper, let me just tell you what it says. It concerns the provision in the income tax proposal. It says that you will tax either the book income or the taxable income, whichever is higher. Sounds like a pretty good deal. What happens, however, is that the same company and a same piece of business over a period will earn the same amount of money, generally speaking, for tax purposes or for book purposes. The difference, however, year to year comes in the depreciation approach. And I asked Charles Fletcher if he could prepare for me an example that would illustrate this in principle. This is a document you have, not offered to confuse you, but hopefully a simple example. What it simply says is this. For tax purposes, a company may elect to use the sum of the years with the approach, which means that you take more depreciation at the front end and less at the other. For book income purposes, reporting to a stockholder, it may take simply a straight line depreciation. Now, what happens when you say you take on a year by year basis, whichever is higher? You're getting the best of both worlds. Picking too high means you thought, inevitably, that you end up with more than 100%. I asked Charlie if he could prove it. What he's done here is to create a simple illustrative case so you can see the principle at work. And it takes a company that says invest $2,000 in a project having a life of 5 years. And it elects to write off for income tax purposes its depreciation on a sum of the year's basis. In other words, an accelerated depreciation. And for financial reporting purposes, it takes it on a straight line basis. What the numbers show you is that if profit changes year on year, depending on which basis you calculate, and you can compare the taxable income on line 5 with the financial income before tax on line 7. Line 8 simply applies the proposed statute because they take the higher one. But an interesting thing happens when you get out to the column at the far right, because under both the federal taxable, you see that they had $2,000 worth of income in the five-year example, in either case. But on take your pick, whichever is higher, they're taxing $2,400, not $2,000. Then you have the duplicative tax effect. And what it means, for example, is you're taxing nearly 20% more income than they actually have. Convert it to what that means at a 9.4 rate. It means that the effective rate of tax jumps to 11.2 as a result of the mechanism that says take your pick, whichever is higher. It's a technical thing, yet there it was, sort of laying in the woodwork, well intended, but it does have a duplicate effect. I did just want to call it to your attention. Final point in reference to this franchise tax proposal, which I think the committee ought to consider, is whether the effect of a $250 million floor to exempt local producers while concentrating the impact of the tax on the multi-state producers. I understand these interests that this provision is designed to protect, and I'm simply with it. But the legal question, and that's a different one, the standing actual effect of this be reconciled with the notion of fairness under the Commerce Clause. The other proposals, separate accounting and so forth, really have many of the same comments and deserve the same analysis. I'd also just call your attention to the discussion of fairness on page 24. It's fairly obvious, but the gut question appears at the top of page 23. And ask, is it worth a major statutory departure from the Interstate Compact In the case of the state's largest industry, would that be consistent with the state's continued membership in the compact law of purpose? Well, so much for the legality and the aspect there. These are the questions that in our staff, our tax staff, our legal staff, and our outside counsel gave me sort of a first report, and was aware that I would pass it along to you for whatever you support. The second major questionnaire that you focused on yesterday, the subject of economic rent. And more to the point, this is a windfall. Who gets it? It's a blatant way to say the question, but really that struck me if you were asking. I don't think there's anything wrong with the mechanical qualities of the calculators that anybody was using who specified this for you. They all add up the same set of numbers. But there is a fundamental difference in what investment they chose to analyze. Most of the government witnesses choose to look at only the oil field, and on that basis they push around some pretty fancy numbers. But the field is only part of the investment. Any company taking the plunge in Prudhoe Bay had to figure in the cost of the pipeline, the port facilities at Valdez, and the necessary Jones Act fencing. They couldn't pick the best part of it, do only that part. They had to face up to the whole risk, finance their whole share of it, and figure the return on that. Interestingly enough, we've had a number of inquiries from time to time from the Department of Justice. Wouldn't somebody like to take a piece of the pipeline? The answer is, sir, the door has been open for 7 years. There are no volunteers. It's such a good deal and stands on its own and the risk is so nominal, we just cut the line at the door. There have been a number of companies that have been quite willing to share that joy. There are no takers. It is simply another piece of proof that there are any of us that had to take the plunge and fill it down, took the whole plunge. The pipeline, the tankers, the port, the field. We did this. This is the way we actually looked at it. Included our investment bankers, included our lenders. And these are the people that have to come up with the money. This is not hypothetical speculation or opinion. This is hard raising money to do a job. A year ago, I testified about this specific point. I think it was before the Joint House and Senate Resources Committee. The date that sticks in my mind is March 29th. I can probably find the testimony if you had some interest. But there I reported that at least three times since our merger with BP, Ohio has run its own tape on what its rate of return expectancy was on the total project, the total commitment that it had. One was done in 1970, shortly after the merger. The other was done, I think, in 1973, shortly before the OPEC price move, but after a lot of delay and litigation and other cost things have changed. And the most recent one was done about in February 1976. I'm going on memory at this point. I don't have it with me, but I think this is the essence of it. And interestingly enough, at each time, 70, 73, 76, in spite of all the changes that occurred in those periods, our anticipated rate of return remained in a range of 14 to 16% on the total project. I have to confess to you, in my judgment, it was more luck than judgment that that was so. But I want to tell you why we figured out that it remained constant. What really happened? Most of you know, and I think there's been testimony of the effect, the world oil prices went up 400%. That's true. The second thing is that the cost of the total project, steel, pipeline, tankers, and oil, also went up about 400%. Now, what that meant to Ohio was, instead of investing a dollar and getting a 15% return on that, we are now faced up to the investment of four times that much. $4 in effect for every one, with a 15% return on the four. No more profit per dollar, just an awful lot more risk for dollars invested. There wasn't any windfall there. If there's a windfall, really it's come in two places. And there's been some public acknowledgement of it. First is Uncle Sam. There's whatever profits are earned, he takes off the top. About half. Second thing comes from the state itself. I want to point this out, and I don't want you to feel like I'm begrudging the state. and I think it's been one of the primary beneficiaries of all of this change. It's royalty. It's probably going to be worth four times as much as it was. It's got 400%. Its severance tax will reflect this, 400%. There was a substantial increase in the cost of facilities. I don't know that it was 400% dollar for dollar, but its ad valorem tax will reflect the same thing. And to the extent there is more income in quantity, there's not more on a percentage rate of return basis. Whatever income taxes you have benefit from that. So you're a four-time winner, frankly, without a dollar of investment. And that's where some of the windfall has come, but this is one of the positions that has helped many governments across the country bail themselves out in meeting various people needs. It's a factor that's playing right here in Alaska. Well, in terms of economic rent, on the pipeline and fast, I'd have to say the 15%, it's the low end of our preferred range going in. Fortunately, that it's still there. New fields that may be discovered, and we hope to have some of that action here in Alaska ourselves, will have to be pretty substantial, the economics, in these terms. In this regard, I'd like to direct your attention to the testimony of Mr. David T. Goodman. And he testified before the Federal Energy Administration in Washington on March 21st. He was testifying on the Alaskan oil price. But some of the words that he said had particular application to the kinds of things that were present here today. And I'd like to direct you just to a few of them. Mr. Goodman, as you may or may not know, is a managing director of Morgan Stanley, investment banker in New York. He's also a member of the Energy Financial Advisory Committee of the Federal Energy Administration itself. I think his words are particularly important because his firm arranged over $5.5 billion of the financing that went into Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And he personally had the responsibility for over $5 billion of that. He's the guy that raised most of the money that we brought to Alaska to do the work. In the course of his work, he had a number of in-depth discussions with more than 70 major institutional investors regarding the financing of this large project and some others that he worked on. The testimony before the FEA, attachment E to my testimony, you may want to read the whole thing, has a couple points here that I think are important. Would you turn to page 28 and see the quotation from it? He was talking about the risk elements of Alaska Northwest development and the appropriate rate of return for projects like Prudhoe Bay and Pass. And he said this is a quote. These hearings, meaning FEA, are also investigating the risk elements of North Slope development and the appropriate rate of return for this project. Both of these subjects were obviously matters of great interest to investors. This project is one of the riskiest ever undertaken by industry. The important risks aren't those cited by the Morcata study. The cost of exploration before the Prudhoe Bay discovery well is insignificant compared with the risk undertaken by the industry in going ahead with the project under the Pipeline Right-of-Way Act. The participants were committed to complete the project no matter what the cost in the face of absolute federal and state control over construction. Remember that this project has been delayed for over 4 years by court intervention and government redesign. Compliance with these actions had already more than doubled costs. Yet the industry was forced to accept a set of stipulations far more exacting than any ever applied to such construction before. Stipulations that many in the industry were concerned about being physically able to comply with and to proceed with the absolute authority vested in one man for all construction or required design changes that could cause costs to skyrocket with no accountability for effectiveness. The industry undertook these absolute obligations and the cost did rise to the point where if Alaska North Slope crude is allowed to compete against world oil. The Morcata study and the industry figures indicate that the project will earn a discounted rate of return in the area of 14-16%. Morcata states that a return of 12% should be equitable. And there may be some analogy to returns allowed to regulated industries in Morcata's thinking, although even higher returns are allowed and risky startup ventures there. But regulated returns involve an exclusive franchise, wherein subsequent rate regulation assures such a return. No one is assuring the price of Alaskan or world oil. If we had projected a 12% return from the outset, I'm not sure the project could have been financed. It's our experience that oil companies will not undertake a project involving any significant risk for a projected return of under 15%. The industry will earn returns of approximately 22% in the British North Sea, where they have experienced retroactive majority participation by the British government. The financial institutions who invest in the equity of the lease tankers for the Valdez trade will earn a discounted after-tax return in excess of 15% with the benefit of a hell or high water at all events charter, that's the one that takes all the risk, from the other oil companies. Based on these facts, I can't accept a 12% return as equitable for a project of the magnitude and riskiness of the North Slope project. The aggregate earnings of the North Slope will be very large. It is one, if not the largest oil field ever found outside the Middle East. But the costs are high, and the rate of return will be modest, particularly bearing in mind the risk. If you want industry to be able to finance the development of major energy discoveries this country so sorely needs, particularly the smaller companies you want to favor in your OCS leasing policy, do not make the wrong decision in pricing Alaskan North Slope crude oil. It's critical with regard to establishing an overall energy policy, of which the issue of pricing Alaskan North Slope crude oil can be looked on as an important first step to retain the willingness of the private sector to provide financing of future energy projects. The rate of return and windfall and economic rent has had a lot of discussion. I was kind of surprised yesterday that no one asked the ultimate question, because there is one, and while it's a somewhat complicated subject, there is a standard that almost anyone could apply and decide for themselves, almost on instinct, what fits. Ask the question as you get into these things: would you invest some of your own money in one of these oil companies, given these conditions of test? If you would, then probably the companies are earning their fair share. If not, you've answered your own question, the state has asked for more than it's worth. And again, I suggest this not to be argumentative. When you put your own dollars into it, whether it's an automobile, an apartment house, a business venture, 100 shares in oil stock, or whatever it is, you make your decision. Am I going to get a fair rate of return to a point where I put my own money in? Not the world's greatest choice, but a reasonably prudent investment. I think you can begin to get the answers in that sort of approach. Because you begin in your own mind to get some perspective of the risk and the people who have to show you. Not a trick question, straight up there. The third subject that's come up here and you've asked some questions about concerns Dr. Michael Tanzer's report number 2. I'd like to make just a few observations, and I understand that other witnesses you've scheduled are going to comment on it in more detail. I read the report number 2 with interest. I found that I was rather selectively cited in a couple instances in that report. And I discovered that Dr. Tanzer and I have at least one common interest in poultry. If you read the report, you know what I refer to, but basically what I'm saying is that while we have a common interest in poultry, I tend to prefer the little red hen breed, whereas he seems to run to henny penny. Three observations about this report. First, the henny penny tactic is a very interesting one. By asserting that anyone from our industry will always proclaim that the sky is falling, no matter what is proposed by any legislative body, Dr. Tanzer kind of admits that he's not listening to responses concerned that may be coming from time to time from individuals in an industry from native corporations that would like to be involved in that industry, from all kinds of businesses and employees of those businesses supporting that industry who have an interest in its economic health. And by this device, he really manages to avoid or duck the hard questions that such tax proposals raise. Second observation is to note the essence of what Dr. Tanger's report number 2 really says. He does state that as an outside observer, it's very difficult to judge an oil company's reaction. But they are, of course, based on many factors, not just taxes. That's true. But then he leaps to the conclusion that Alaska can tax our industry almost at will, and that somehow we'll just swallow it. And finally, suggests, or perhaps admits, that if the state does overreach, that's all right. Because in his judgment, the state should take over the Alaskan oil business for itself. My third observation is to note the hard questions that Dr. Tanger ignores. There are 3, and they're all important. And also, let me list them for you in order of increasing importance. First, he bases his analysis on only part of the investment, and only part of the risk. We talked a little bit about that. Second, he ignores the United States and the Alaskan Constitution. We can say more about that. Third, he disregards the hopes and desires and concerns of the people of Alaska. Last year at this time, they came off the bench, flatly rejecting Tanger-type thinking. Do you remember who they were? All the Native Regional Corporations, labor, Alaskan businesses, Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation, a group of citizens from Kena, bankers, lawyers, chamber of commerce, the media, and good people. I know you are. I know you are there too. Dr. Tanger's second effort is really not very good. If there's any interest in pursuing it, just take it back to the people of Alaska and ask them to do it. You may detect that I have some strong feelings about this subject. I have. And I have some difficulty with someone who keeps trying to write my feature for me and won't come and look me in the eye. Well, where are we? One minute. In the first 2 or 3 pages of the testimony in March, you'll see some discussion, Mr. Chairman, of how our hopes went way up the hill and marched down again, and the possibility of getting some kind of a careful look at what kind of long-term tax releasing policy might be appropriate for the state, for our industry, and the people of Alaska. I quoted the words of the governor there. I referred to the Senate's Return Resolution 101, which got it started. I tried to give a summary report of it just never happened. As far as I'm concerned, I respectfully suggest that since the state's near-term revenue needs are well covered, and since we all have major price questions pending in Washington, and since the state government our industry and the people of Alaska still need to resolve this, that the bills before your committee be deferred, but be incorporated under such a study, a policy study. What you're looking for, I think, still is a proper balance to be struck, stability, so that we can all know where we are. Personally, I don't think it's too late to do so. For my own company, I have to be ready to be as well. Thank you.
Now, Yeah.